Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library for this very special event. I am Sarah Holliday, Head of Events, and I am only standing here to go over a couple of points of business. Thank you for cueing the first one. First of all, I'd just like to point out that the Odyssey takes place in the ancient world before there were cell phones. So let us please behave as though we are in the ancient world. We'll have amplification, but no cell phones. If you don't mind silencing them, that would be great. We do have copies of Dr. Wilson's translation of the Odyssey for sale from our friends from the Corner Bookstore in the Caruso Family Exhibition Gallery. I think there are only two copies left, so if you didn't get one coming in afterwards, and Dr. Wilson would be happy to sign copies of that. You may have seen on your seats this fun little yellow flyer saying that if you've read this translation of the Odyssey, you're in the middle of it, you're enthusiastic about it, whatever, you're welcome to join us on Thursday, November 29th at 6 p.m. in the Whitridge Room. We'll just do a very informal book club style discussion of it. And that'll be facilitated by Jen Conrad Zimmer, who's a library member, author, and author of Daughters and Samurai. So that'll be a nice evening. And it's my pleasure to bring to the podium Donald McDonough, who is one of our repeat seminar leaders here at the library, and will introduce our main speaker. Thank you.
We're lucky, right, to have somebody who coming from Oxford, Balliol, Corpus Christi, and going on to Yale, and now at the University of Pennsylvania, having translated Euripides, written the life of Seneca, and going on, right, coming to us with a superb translation of the Odyssey. Everybody here has probably been reading about her widely, correctly applauded opening of the Odyssey. Under my editor, Mr. Richard Morris Walpole, suddenly becomes tell me about a complicated man. And then, at the very end of the work, right, when Athena is talking to him, is to be making peace among his own friends, says, you're an adaptable fellow. But maybe one of the things that I so much enjoyed about the right words that she chose was when Penelope is talking to her nurse, who says, your husband's downstairs. She doesn't believe it, right? But she says, right, in Greek, right, he's come from Kekko Ilion. Ilion is the other name for Troy. And our speaker today, Emily Wilson, has done a wonderful portmanteau word and said, he comes from Evil Ilion. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, Emily Wilson.
Female in English translator of the Odyssey. Most people have probably seen some of the media coverage, so I thought maybe I should spend a couple of minutes and start talking about that, and then I'll move on to talking about what I was trying to achieve in doing yet another translation into English of this already very much translated poem. So it seems to me that some of the media coverage focused on my gender has been sort of both pros and cons towards that. I think it's a great thing if that that coverage is opening people's eyes to the fact that social identities matter for the words we write, for how we speak, whether we're historians or journalists or translators or novelists or whatever it may be. I think it's a good thing if there are young people, including non-male young people, who might be inspired to think, I can be a classicist too. But I also think there are certain issues with defining whatever I was trying to do in this translation exclusively by my gender, which has sometimes happened. One thing is that it seems to put the headline in the wrong place. I think the headline should be really about why is the field of classical translation so male-dominated in the English-speaking world? It's not the case in other languages. There are plenty of translations of the Odyssey into, there are several in French by women, there's at least two, maybe more, into Italian by women. There's one by a woman in Dutch, there's one by a woman in Turkish, and so on. So it's a problem with the specifics of the contemporary English-speaking world that the vast majority of translations from ancient Greek and Latin, not just Homer, are by usually very old white men. So that's actually a small demographic, and it's a small demographic compared to the number of people who have PhDs in Latin and Greek. Slightly over half PhDs in classics in the States are forwards to women, and yet there's this disparity. But I think it goes far beyond the me and Homer, but it's something that we should talk about, you know, in a broader way than just Emily Wilson as a woman. And then another point I was to make about that is just that I think I get frustrated when interviewers ask me, as they almost always do, how does your unique feminine perspective open our eyes to new things in this poem? Why are you a woman? You must really like the female characters, it's all about female characters. I've listened to and read interviews with my predecessors, such as Robert Fitzgerald, Stanley Lombardo, Robert Fagles. They were never asked, you must have a unique masculine perspective. I just ask you only about the male characters. So my general point in saying that is just that not all women are feminists, not all women have a perspective that's defined exclusively by their gender identity. The fact that I'm paying attention to gender roles and the complexity of the depiction of gender in this poem is something which I decided to do, partly because I've read quite a lot of feminist scholarship about the Odyssey and thought about it quite a lot. It's not predetermined by being a woman. Okay, so I suppose to do that preamble, because it's very often, if people haven't read my translation, the thing they have in their mind is the Buzz Woman headline, so I thought maybe I should talk about that first and get out of the way. We can also talk about some Q&A as well. So I'm going to try not to talk the whole time, because I'd love to hear questions from you, but I just wanted to talk a little bit just to set up why did I decide to take on this translation, given that there were so many already out there. I was asked to consider doing it by Norton, who was a publisher. I already knew this editor there because I'd been involved with the Norton anthologies of both world literature and Western literature. And I was excited to consider doing it because I've always loved this poem. Ever since I was 8 years old, I got to be in the elementary school production of the Odyssey, which of course was a shortened version for kids. And I got to be Athena, and it was an absolute turning point in my life. It was wonderful to play the goddess Athena. I was a shy kid, and it made me realize how much the Greek myths had to say to me in terms of my own experiences of being at home, being at school, being alienated, being lost, trying to figure out what does it mean to have friends or be in a community. And of course, the Odyssey has changed as I've changed and as I've grown up. I don't read it the same way now as I did when I was 8. But I think it's an amazing poem in that it is actually about how are you different and the same over time. How is your relationship to home, to family, to communities, to people who aren't like you? How does that change at different moments in your life? Can you be like Odysseus and try and turn back so 20 years can go by, you're still just the same, that home is just the same? Or is that not possible? I think it's about all these questions I think about all the time in daily life as well as intellectual life, about time, identity, about how to deal with people who aren't like us, about hiding, rage, growing up, grief, imagination, recognition. I also love how it's a poem that turns the very pragmatic or material details of everyday life, like furniture and moving through space, boats, weapons, trees, weaving into these concrete symbols that define human and divine relationships, and that it both has this concreteness and also this magicalness, that it's both a world where you're going to get very, very detailed descriptions about how every meal is made and how people put on their sandals, but then also you know that at any moment a goddess could appear and then fly away like a bird. I also love how it sounds. I love how the Homeric Greek sounds when you read it out loud and when you read it. But loving the poem and wanting to keep on rereading it and be with it for another 40 years is a different thing from deciding it's worthwhile to produce another literary verse translation in English. That's obviously a creative writing project and also a scholarly interpretive one. It has all these different layers to it. It's a huge job. I knew it would take me at least 5 years. I knew it wasn't worth spending 5 years doing that unless there was actually something I would do that would be authentically engaged with the original in a way that wasn't exactly the same as what was already available. It wasn't worth it if I was just going to replicate what had already been done. So then I did the exercise of just looking closely at a passage of the Greek next to a dozen or so of the most commonly read translations, and I realized doing that there were things that I wanted to do that were not being done in the ones I was looking at. It wasn't that they were all bad, but unless I knew I had a vision for how to do it a different way. So I'm just going to talk about some of the things I wanted to do that were sort of definitional for the project. And I should also just say that, after look after doing that experiment, I then put all the other translations away. I didn't look at them for another 5 years. Since publishing my translation, I've then gone back and done some close comparisons, because people, I'm constantly talking to people who don't know Greek and want to know how is your translation different from XYZ other translation. So I wanted to know what the answer to that is. And I now know what the answer to that is in ways I didn't a year ago. So one thing that drove me to want to do it in the first place, right from the start, was the awareness that a huge number of the most commonly read translations in English, contemporary ones, are not in a regular meter. That it's very, that a lot of them are in prose, or else they're in free verse. They're laid out like verse, but they don't have any kind of regular rhythm. Of course, as the introducer just emphasized, the original is in dactylic hexameter. Dactyl is a finger, so of course it has the long, short. And ramoi enepe musapolutroponpos malapolla. It's six all the way through, right? It's hexameters. It doesn't suddenly go into a different rhythm because the poet decided it would be nice to try some free verse. So it seems to me that to my experience of reading Homer in Greek, the rhythmical, musical regularity of the language seems essential to the experience of it. Of course, that's also part of the legacy of the oral tradition. This is a poem which emerged out of a centuries-long oral tradition from the period when the Greek-speaking world had no reading or writing, had no alphabet. So to translate it into a language which doesn't have a regular rhythm seemed to me to be missing a whole part of the experience. So I chose to use iambic pentameter instead of dactylic hexameter because I wanted to use the literary equivalent of dactylic hexameter. Of course, in English, in Anglophone verse, poets don't normally use hexameters for writing epic or writing drama. So I wanted to use the verse form that in English is the signals narrative verse. Another decision I made at the start, which I sometimes kicked myself off because it was very difficult, was to make it the same length as the original in terms of lines. Because I was aware that both for Homer, but this is true for translations in general, there's always a temptation to make the translation longer than the original. Because of course you always know this word, it connotes things that no single English word connotes. So there are maybe 50 possible words I could use. Then we plunk down five of them, just to cover all my bases. And then you end up with a translation that's quite a lot longer than the original. And it's going to have certain advantages that you're able to say, this means this, and this, and this, and this, and this. But it also means that you lose the pacing. Again, just in the experience of reading Homer in Greek, it seemed to me that the propulsive forward movement, the rapidity of the narrative, that you're not actually given any time whatsoever to get bored, was a really important element that I wanted to try and be responsible to. And I knew I couldn't do that unless I decided ahead of time I'm really going to pay very close attention to that. Because if I hadn't chosen to do it, it wouldn't have happened. And then in general, I wanted to try and convey something of the directness of Homeric verse style. That Homer is composed in what is both a weird kind of Greek, because it's based on multiple different dialects from multiple different eras, but it's also not at all difficult. It's extremely easy, direct syntax. It's a lot of coordinated syntax rather than subordinated. So it's a lot of, and then he put on his sandals, and then he put on his cloak, and then he put on his tunic, and then he grasped his golden spear, and so on. But it's not a lot of complicated sentences of the kind you might get in Paradise Lost. So I wanted to have a kind of directness about the way that I tried to convey Homer's voice in English. I also wanted to avoid thinking, because Homer is very, very ancient, he has to speak in a language that's cluttered up with archaisms. Because I don't think that actually conveys the way that Homer sounds, right? It suggests this is an English which sounds like Victorian English, but that Victorian English doesn't sound more like Homeric Greek than nowadays English. Right? Neither one of them is like Greek. I also wanted not to do a whole lot of foreignisms. I think there's a tendency among classicists to think that the kind of translation which replicates the experience of the intermediate student in Latin or Greek 101 or 201 is more authentic because it sort of shows you can't quite understand this language. But as I said, I think Homeric Greek is not very difficult, and so therefore the decision to translate in a way that makes it more difficult than the original seems problematic to me. I didn't want to make it more difficult to read than the original is. I also wanted to try, in general, to have a range of different registers, including it can be whimsical, it can be cute, it can be funny. It doesn't have to be highfalutin, grand, booming, epic all the time. Epic can include more than that. I think the later history of English epic, and the fact that we have Milton, we have Pope's Homer, may make us think of epic style in terms that aren't necessarily truthful to how Homer sounds. I wanted to inject something of the conversational simplicity of other Anglophone poets into the way I wrote, rather than think it's all got to sound very, very grand all the time as if I'm constantly shouting at you. My translation, I think, I wanted, but at the same time as saying I didn't want to be too bombastic, I also didn't want to be absolutely writing in the same way as I'm talking to you right now. Even beyond the fact that right now I'm not talking in iambic pentameter, I also wanted to have some other markers that this isn't quite the same as real, as normal speech. So for instance, I avoided all contractions. I didn't have any instances of doesn't or couldn't, just as a way of marking. This isn't necessarily always difficult in a vocabulary words kind of way, but it's marked as not quite the same as regular speech. The original, as I just said, is in a very artificial language, which is the product of a long oral tradition. It includes different dialects mixed in there. I agonized a lot about the fact that I thought I couldn't fully echo that. I couldn't do a translation that would be a mix of Chaucerian English with some Californian, with some Norwegian, with some Cockney, and just mix it all together, even though that would have been kind of really fun to do. Because if I were to do that, I would also, you wouldn't have been here, so nobody would read it. And it would also just lose what I was saying before about how Homer has this simplicity and directness. Because it's actually based on a real tradition, rather than a tradition that I just made up in order to translate Homer. So I was aware that my language isn't going to be quite as mixed or weird or diverse as Homer's language is, because that was just the payoff for getting the other things that I felt were essential, one of which was this simplicity and directness, and then other things that included emotional intensity and psychological interest, and this poem is actually about things, that it isn't just about language games. Another element that I felt I had to do different things with is the challenge that faces any translator of Homer, is the fact that this is a poem based on an oral tradition and therefore has a lot of repetitions, exact repetitions, and also formulaic set types for how a scene goes, when somebody gets dressed, when somebody puts on armor, and also different set epithets. Odysseus is always going to be one of a range of different things. It's going to be polyklas, polymekanos, polymetis, that particular words apply to particular things when they're in a particular metrical position in the line. I played around with the degree to which I translate repetition by repetition. I have quite a lot of repeated elements, such as a lot of wine dark scenes, wine dark sea, and then here's another wine dark scene. Because I wanted to get the reader to have some flavor of this is quite a repetitious poem. But I didn't repeat as much as the original does, because I was aware that repetition can have a different set of meanings in a literate culture from what it means in a purely oral culture. That in a purely oral culture, you repeat things that really matter, because that's how that's the only way to preserve it. You can't play it back later, you can't read it out loud later. Whereas in a very literate culture like ours, repetition tends to mean either I am Gertrude Stein, I am Gertrude Stein, I am Gertrude Stein, or else it means, more likely, it means this is a cliche that I'm just repeating because I haven't bothered to think of a different way to say it. So it doesn't matter and you can skip. And I don't think that repetition in Homer means either of those things. So I therefore decided I'm going to repeat less, and I'm going to play around with repeated elements and do different things with them to make sure that the reader isn't being told, you can skip, it doesn't matter. So for instance, in the rosy-fingered dawn line, which is repeated over and over and over in the original, I keep that she's a goddess, she has either roses or blooming, and she has fingers or touching, she's newborn or she's early, but I do different things with how those components get mixed up. So just in terms of process, I worked closely with the Greek. As I said, I didn't look at other translations. I read it out loud a lot. I combed through dictionaries and commentaries, trying to figure out what the nuances of every word or phrase might be. And then on a larger scale, I was trying to feel my way inside each of the characters, and each of the relationships, each of the scenes, each of the events. and withdraw the characters to make the richest, most humanly truthful kind of sense they could make. I wrote multiple drafts, and I read them out loud over and over and over to myself, and also to anybody who would listen. And I wanted to, because of course one of my goals was to be sure this poem could work as something to read out loud, which seemed extra important for a poem that's based on an oral tradition, and which was throughout antiquity experienced primarily orally. So in terms of different perspectives, I thought it was essential, and it's also what something I felt when looking at other translations at the start of the project. There was this tendency, I think, to present the Odyssey as if it's always looking only through the eyes of Odysseus. And now theological scholars, especially of the Odyssey, have, over the last few decades, have really drawn our attention, the attention of academics who work on Homer, to the fact that the narrative perspectives in Homer are constantly shifting, that we're not always seeing through the point of view of Odysseus. We're seeing through one point of view, and then it's shifts, and then it shifts again. So I wanted to try and be really thoughtful about that, really attuned to the way it's a poem which has many different voices, many different perspectives, and they don't all sound the same. They don't all agree with each other. I wanted to make sure the reader could feel her way inside the perspectives of every character in the poem, not just Odysseus, Penelope, Telemachus, Athena, the most obvious and elite characters, but even the minor ones, like Elpenor, the boy who gets drunk and falls to his death, or the many slaves, at least four, who are very clearly described in very rounded characters. All the suitors of Antinous and Eurymachus, who are clearly defined as different from each other. All the various characters Odysseus meets along the way, like Calypso or Polyphemus. I think the original poem allows us to feel for and understand each of them. I think Homer has this amazingly broad set of sympathies that we don't just see through one person's eyes. We can feel for multiple different people in the community. The Odyssey is, of course, the story about one man's journey home, his one man's nostos, which is the word for journey home in Greek. But it's also about all these other nostoi, all these other journeys home, which most of which don't happen. The men who leave, 12 boatloads of men who leave Ithaca to go to Troy with Odysseus, zero come home. They don't have a nostos, as the first page of the poem reminds us. This is a story about one man who did make it home and all the others who didn't. We're also shown all the slaves who don't have a home anymore. We're also shown the ways that Odysseus' nostos is experienced differently by all those that it affects. Penelope's perspective on her marriage is not at all the same as Odysseus' perspective on his. I felt looking at other translations, there can be a tendency to sentimentalize the marriage that's at the heart of this poem, which I think very often involves subsuming her perspective to his, rather than being clear-minded about the way that the poem can see both sides. You can see also the pain that's inherent in her social position. In the broadest outline, I wanted to create a version of the Odyssey that would be clear, readable, poetic, musical, and that would encourage and invite a critical, nuanced response to the story it's telling. I've seen from teaching the Odyssey that there can be a tendency to assume that it's a sort of old-school comic book superhero story, about the unproblematically heroic male Western hero, basically proto-white, who's good because he crushes the bad guys and monsters and foreigners, and understands the value of hospitality, which apparently was important back in the ancient days, by having an exam and coaching a name. The story has a happy ending, because the good guy gets back with the objectified wife, and regains all his wealth and all his slaves and all his consumer goods. So it's a nice celebration of family values, consumerism, patriarchy, war, superiority of normal male white people over foreigners and women. Okay, I said at the start, like when I started talking a few minutes ago, that I really like the Odyssey. I hope it's maybe implicit in what I just said, that I wouldn't like it if I felt that was the only thing it was doing. I don't think one should like it if that were the only thing it's doing. I think it's doing a whole lot more than that. It's presenting Odysseus' perspective on his own story, and also the perspectives of all the other people who are not Odysseus, and how their perspectives are actually quite different from his. So I guess a concrete example of how I think complexity can be brought out or else not brought out in translation is that I use the word slave for words that definitely mean slave, but are commonly rendered with either servants or maids or housekeepers, not just in previous translations, but also in ones that have come out after mine. There have been a couple of translations that came out in 2018, and which are still using the word servants for translation for words that definitely mean slaves. And I don't think it's that the translators don't know any Greek. I think they know some Greek, but I think there's a systematic blindness They can be motivated by a desire to idealize the society of Homer in a kind of misguided way, to simplify the poem's, I think, really rich social and ethical thinking by euphemizing elements that might seem disturbing. I think the poem is actually better if we can, is the better for the fact that it's clear-minded about multiple different people's perspectives, multiple different people's sufferings, as well as multiple different people's joy. So I just talked in a kind of abstract way. I thought before we have questions, maybe I should read a couple of passages, just to maybe, I'm not sure what exactly it illustrates, but it'll be illuminating in some way or other for people who haven't yet read any of my translation. I say yet, but you don't have to, if you don't want to. So first I'm going to read the bit from book 12, which has, in some ways is the most well-known. For people who haven't read the Odyssey or haven't read it for many years, you may have the idea that this is a poem that's all about Odysseus wandering around in a boat and meeting lots of scary monsters. So this is one of those bits where Odysseus meets the first the sirens and then Scylla and Charybdis. And it's a passage where, which I think sort of frames a central question of the Odyssey, which is about how adaptable or how versatile is Odysseus? Is he going to go on trying to be the warrior that was the appropriate response to being in the middle of a battlefield where everyone's trying to kill you? Or is he going to be able to adapt to deal with different kinds of threats, some of whom don't carry bronze spears? It might not be appropriate, hurling a bronze spear might not be the appropriate response. So I think it's a passage which sort of frames the question of, does Odysseus really want to be that warrior self, or can he be other selves? And what other selves are there that can respond to different kinds of threats? And it's also a passage which frames what I think is another of many interesting threads in the Odyssey. Another interesting thread is about the dangers to the male protagonist of female mouths. So we have first the mouths and the sirens, which are tempting Odysseus with the possibility of total knowledge, of having something like the internet, or having something like but the internet in which every Google search, the answer is Odysseus. So it's both total knowledge and total salvation for the ego that the sirens promise him. But they promise it with these dangerous female mouths. Of course, if he were to stay and yield to that temptation, he wouldn't have a journey home. And then we have Scylla, who has six mouths, all of which are cannibal mouths. And then we have Charybdis, the whirlpool, who's all mouth, that all she does is drink. So we have these three goddesses who frame the problems of female mouths, female orifices. And of course, we get versions of that danger figured differently in the more realistic books from the Bacchanalia. Okay, so this is Odysseus explaining to his subordinates that Circe has given some instructions about how to deal with the sirens. Then with an anxious heart, I told the crew, "My friends, the revelations Circe shared with me should not be kept a secret, known to me alone. I will share them with you, and we can die in knowledge of the truth, or else escape. She said we must avoid the voices of the otherworldly sirens, steer past their flowering meadow. And she says that I alone should hear their singing. Bind me to keep me upright at the mast, wound round with rope. If I beseech you and command you to set me free, you must increase my bonds and chain me even tighter." So I told them each detail. Soon our well-built ship, blown fast by fair winds, neared the island of the sirens, and suddenly the wind died down. Calm came. Some spirit lulled the waves to sleep. The men got up, pulled down the sails, and stowed them in the hollow hold. They sat ashore and made the water whiten, struck by polished wood. I gripped a wheel of wax between my hands and cut it small. Firm kneading in the sunlight warmed it, and then they rubbed it in the ears of each man in his turn. They bound my hands and feet, straight upright at the mast. They sat and hit the sea with oars. We traveled fast. When we were in earshot of the sirens, they knew our ship was near and started singing. Odysseus, come here. You are well known from many stories, glory of the Greeks. Now stop your ship and listen to our voices. All those who
where music brings them joy, and they go on their way with greater knowledge. Since we know everything, the Greeks and Trojans suffered in Troy, by God's will, and we know whatever happens anywhere on earth.
Their song was so melodious, I longed to listen more.
I told the men to free me.
I scowled at them. They kept rowing on.
Eurylochus and Perimedes stood and tied me even tighter with more knots.
But when we were well past them, and I could no longer hear the singing of the sirens, I nodded to my men, and they removed the wax that I had used to plug their ears and untied me. When we had left that island, I saw a mighty wave and smoke and heard a roar. The men were terrified. Their hands let fall the oars. They splashed down in the water. The ship stayed still, since no one now was pulling the slender blades. I strode along the deck, pausing to cheer each man, and gave a speech to rally all of them. Dear friends, we're experienced in danger. This is not worse than the time the Cyclops captured us and forced us to remain inside his cave. We got away that time, thanks to my skill and brains and strategy. Remember that? Come on then, all of you, and trust my words. Sit on your benches, strike the swelling deep with oars, since you may grant us a way out from this disaster also. Pilot, listen, these are your orders. As you hold the rudder, direct the ship away from that dark smoke and rising wave, and head towards the rock. If the ship veers the other way, it will endanger us. They promptly followed orders. I did not mention Scylla, since she meant inevitable death. And if they knew, the men would drop the oars and go and huddle down in the hold in fear. Then I ignored Circe's advice that I should not bear arms. It was too hard for me. I dressed myself in glorious armor. In my hands I took two long spears and I climbed up on the forecastle. I thought that rocky Scylla would appear from that direction to destroy my men. So we rode through the narrow strait in tears. On one side, Scylla. On the other, shining Charybdis with a dreadful gurgling noise sucked down the water. When she spewed it out, she seethed, all churning like a boiling cauldron on a huge fire. The froth flew high to spatter the topmost rocks on either side. But when she swallowed back the sea, she seemed all stirred from inside, and the rock around was roaring dreadfully, and dark blue sand below was visible. The men were seized by fear. But while our frightened gaze was on Charybdis, Scylla snatched six men from the ship, my strongest, best fighters. Looking back from down below, I saw their feet and hands up high as they were carried off. In agony, they cried to me and called my name, their final words, as when a fisherman out on a cliff casts his long rod and lines it round with oxhorn to trick the little fishes with his bait. When one is caught, he flings it gasping back onto the shore. So those men gasped as Scylla lifted them up high to her rocky cave, and at the entrance ate them up, still screaming, still reaching out to me in their death throes. That was the most heartrending sight I saw in all the time I suffered on the sea. Okay, so I'm thinking we should have question time now, right? We're going to have a lot of time so you can ask questions. Which might or might not be right. Yes. Yes.
when you're doing the reading, you're doing these wonderful voices for the characters we're speaking. When you translated, did you think of characters in different dramatic voices? Like, you know, it sounds a certain way that's different.
I didn't manage being out loud to myself in the process, put on the silly voices that I put on, on the show. I see the performative element now is meant to be a sort of corresponds to. I thought hard about that, about character arc and character perspective, which I didn't necessarily always think of in terms of which voice would I put on when I do that. I mean, that's a sort of later incrustation on in the process. But I definitely thought about how do I want both how do I want the character to sound, but also what I want the character to be like.
What's nice about it is in the translation they seem different. It doesn't seem like the narrator should be in all the voices.
Good, well, I hope it seems different even on page, yes.
I loved your description of how you went about this enormous task and your kind of summary of what you tried to bring to this work. And I wondered, as you were talking about that, what was your biggest challenge? What was the thing that you struggled most with?
There were so many struggles all the time. I mean, the whole thing was struggle. I mean, the whole thing was both joy and struggle all the time. And then it's hard to put it in sort of macroscopic ways. I mean, I spent a lot of time just thinking about synonyms and thinking about how here are all these words for moving quickly through space. None of them are quite the same as any English word for moving quickly through space. And I can't just say rushing all the time because that makes everybody sound too New York. that kind of thing. I don't mean that as the only example, but just as a thousand things kind of like that. It wasn't that, most of the time it would be, this is a very easy, straightforward passage of Greek, it's not difficult to understand what it's saying, it's not even difficult to understand what it's doing on the level of, I can see the various effects with the rhythms and the alliterations and so on, but then how do I put that into something which does some of the same things? That was very, very difficult, yeah.
Yes, could you just take us through how you got the complicated in the first
sure.
line?
Yes. So the word I translate as complicated is polythropos is an accusative case. So polu, as in polygamy, means many, and tropos is cognate with the verb to turn. So it suggests something like much turning. Much turning is not an English word. So I didn't want to use something that's not an English word. I wanted to use something which is definitely an actual word, because polytropos is an actual word, not a made up thing. And also, English doesn't do nearly as many compound words with melding different bits together as German or Homeric Greek does. So that was also, in general, a problem, but it was a problem for this in particular as well. So I wanted something that would convey something or other that was not just about Odysseus, but also about the poem and about the journey, because we know from later usage of polytropos that at least later on it was used to describe situations as well as people. So it seems to me that the use of this, not the most common epithet of Odysseus in the first line, is something potentially programmatic about that. It's saying something about what kind of poem is the Odyssey. It's a much turny kind of poem. So I wanted something that would say something about what is this poem and what is this translation? What am I trying to get the reader to watch out for? I'm trying to say watch out for complexity. I went through different possibilities in terms of if I want to keep a metaphor of turnedness and I want a real English word, there were many that are just not usable, right? I mean, I can't say kinky man or perverted man, right? those have the right metaphor, but they don't mean the right thing. So I felt that complicated in a way was a kind of compromise because it has it implies layeredness. It doesn't necessarily imply quite the same kind of turning. But I felt I couldn't quite get to all the bases I wanted to touch unless I made some kind of compromise, and that was the best I could do. Yeah.
Thank you.
You said when you looked at the Greek text, you saw there were a lot of things you would do differently. Is there a single decided Greek authoritative text, or did you have to decide among which Greek texts?
I just used the Oxford Classical text primarily, and I occasionally edited others, but I mostly just relied on that. And I was aware that, again, if I were going to do a re-edition, then it would, you know, take another 20 years, and that would be a whole lot of process, and that I was just going to have to rely on a standard text.
And what is the origin of that? I don't know that text. Where does it date from?
The Oxford Classical Text is one of the modern editions. It's like all modern editions, it's based on the work of the Homeric scholars of antiquity, the scholars who worked on the text of Homer in the Library of Alexandria in the second or third century. So that's when the texts of Homer were sort of established as in a more nailed down way than they had been in earlier centuries. Yeah.
In your translation, you use the word goddess a lot for Calypso, while in other translations you use nymph.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if that was a personal choice, or it was sort of like how people use serf instead of slave, or because of the iambic
pentameter. In that case, definitely not the second, because obviously if you're trying to write a pentameter for a hexameter, you're motivated to go for monosyllables. So nymph would have been easy, but I didn't use it very much, despite the fact that it would have been useful. Because I see nymph as kind of a false friend. Nymphaire suggests goddess, and Calypso is definitely a goddess. Nymph in English suggests a female person whose sexual desire should be mocked, right? I mean, it's just nympho. And that's not actually it's not at all truthful to the way that Calypso is being depicted in Book 5, but she's not being depicted as she's hysterical, there's something wrong with her, she shouldn't want him. She's being depicted as a very powerful female divine being. So I think goddess gets to powerful female divine being better than nymph does. So, yeah. Yes?
So, one of the many things that intrigues me is the discoveries in a somewhat pre-modern Serbia in the 1930s, where there were living extant epic poems that people who were in that mood, and I forget the name of the person who went there.
Norman Parry.
And it's amazing that these traditions could have lived on in the pre-modern Serbia.
Mm-hmm. It is, yes. Yes, so for people who don't know, the study of the Homeric question, the whole study of how did we get the poem that we get, how did it come into being out of an oral tradition, That was all, a lot of progress was made on that question in the early 20th century by the researchers of both Milman Parry and his student Albert Lord, who went and studied the living oral tradition in what was then Yugoslavia, and realized that certain components of Homeric verse are clearly features of oral poetry. But then, I mean, since then, people have done studies of other oral traditions around the world. I mean, there's the Santiago, the Epic of Mali, there are other sort of equivalents, and one thing that's been emphasized in those researches is that they're not all the same. That, I mean, if you just take Homer and the Serbian traditions and you try and find comparisons, and you think everything that's similar is going to be what all oral traditions are like, then you actually, that's wrong, because there are oral traditions which are not quite like that. So it doesn't solve all the questions you might want to have answered about Homeric poetry. And of course, it's also kind of a problem for that way of solving the Homeric problems, that there are too many people who are literate in the world now. You know, it would be good if there were more societies where there was no knowledge of reading and writing. Of course, that's kind of gone. Yes?
How, in the process of translation, how did your relationship with English, the English language, change? And are you planning to translate the Iliad?
Second question, yes.
Oh, you are.
Yes, I still. And first question, I'm not sure. I mean, writing this wasn't the only English writing or English speaking I was doing. The fact that I was trying to write in this particular way for this particular project, and also trying to create what in a way is a fairly stripped down version of English, because I'm trying to create a fairly simple direct syntax, and I end up using quite a lot of monosyllables because I'm writing pentameters that have to fit to be equivalent to hexameters. and made me conscious of the wealth of resources in English for fairly short, direct words. And that even though I also spent a lot of time reading thesauri and trying to figure out what other words are that I could use, what other phrases are there that I could use that might be in something like this general field, it made me aware of how there's a whole lot you can do in English, even if you don't use a lot of words like complicated, right? I use some words that are longer, like complicated, but even if you don't use that many, you don't have to sound like Peter and Jane play ball, even if you do use a fairly stripped down English. That will involve some kind of community building and also will involve some awareness that the reader was also going to get about how are different homes different. But of course, in the course of Odysseus' journey, we're going to glimpse how some fantastical and non-Greek homes are all different from each other. The home of the goddess Calypso is different from the home of the goddess Circe. Whereas in Telemachus' journey, we also, on a much smaller scale, we see how even among the veterans of Troy, who are all within the same community, cultures and food ways and the ways you set up your household are very different from each other. We see a big contrast between the house of Ithaca, the house of Nestor, the much more traditional house of Nestor, the poor, barren, stony house of Ithaca, Telemachus and his mama being bullied, and then the rich, Nouveau-Riche house of Menelaus. So I think it's also just about the way that the poem is interested in storytelling and in this very complicated mode of storytelling. It certainly doesn't go from here you are starting with the start of Odysseus' journey when he first leaves Troy and then dot, 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 we'll go year by year in an analytic way. It's very much the opposite of analytic. And in a way, the Iliad does similar things. I mean, I think it's more obvious with the Odyssey that it's all a process of circles and backtracking and inset narratives. But even the Iliad has some really interesting awareness of narrative and of how you can tell a huge story in a tiny story.
I think that what you describe as the stripped down language that you're using is ravishingly beautiful. And then what makes it even more beautiful is that every once in a while you'll drop in a word like the word I looked up in my reading this morning, ossifrage.
I love that word.
What makes you choose those archaic words? Why in that moment do you reach for a word that the reader has to go and look for?
Yes. I don't feel like I had a general rule about how to do that. I mean, part of me wanted to do it kind of more than I ended up doing, and it was always sort of, maybe this is one of the many things I struggled with, is how many times can I get away with doing that? I mean, I think if it's the epiphany of a goddess, you can afford to put in a magical word, but you can't put in too many because then you lose the magic. But I partly wanted it, I was saying at the start that one of the things I love about the Odyssey is the way that it has both this very pragmatic concreteness and also the sense that there are goddesses walking among us. And I wanted to do something like that linguistically by having this sense that sometimes it's all very easily comprehensible, and then, oh, that's a weird word. Yes.
I too love this translation, and one of the things that made it so wonderful to me was the alliteration. I'm wondering if the Homeric Greek had that much alliteration. Your translation.
Yes, Homer does have a lot of alliteration. And so for instance, in the passage I just read, I editorate a lot in, for instance, the description of Charybdis, which I hope, the original also editorates a lot in the description of Charybdis. I don't think it's absolutely sort of consistent that it's always as alliterative. I think there's a piling on of alliteration at particular moments. I mean, very often similes and descriptive passages have more alliteration than some speeches do. But yes, it's, even though in some ways Homeric verse has a kind of simplicity to it, it's not full of very, very ornate rhetorical figures in a Miltonic way. It definitely has poetic features, and one of them is, even if we don't know exactly how the vowel sounds work, we can still tell this alliteration.
To go crazy with the feminist question, but what do you think of the theory, Samuel Butler, that the Odyssey might have been written by a woman?
Yes, Samuel Butler, the novelist who wrote Erewhon and also did a prose translation of the Odyssey, wrote this crazy little pamphlet called The Authoress of the Odyssey, in which he argues that the Odyssey was by a headstrong Sicilian girl. But you can tell that from various clues, one of which is that there's not much fighting, and what there is no good. It's not a girl. And also there are a lot of female characters, and only a girl would be interested in that kind of thing. So I don't think either of those are particularly compelling arguments, given that we don't have evidence for, I mean, both for their sexism, but also because we don't have evidence for female Iodori or female Lepsos in the archaic Greek world. There was Sappho. It's not that a woman couldn't be a poet in archaic Greece, but we also don't have evidence for how different was archaic jazz was from whatever the cultures were in which this poem was being produced. I don't know. I think it would be nice to imagine that Homer is a woman, but I think it's just a fantasy. There isn't any evidence for it. Yeah. Yes.
So going back to the feminist question, the authors that have endorsed me.
The publisher picked the quotes, not me. I think it's part. I don't know. My lovely quotes. My lovely woman. I think there's a combination of things. One is that I think books by women tend to get sent to women reviewers much more than books by men do. Right? I mean, if I were a man, I think it would have been reviewed much more widely by men. I think it's great that it's a way of sort of packaging Homer so that it says this is not a book which is only by and for men and only endorsed by men. I mean, I think it's a way of sort of flagging one of the things the cover also flags, which is that this is relevant to women. Female voices are going to be listened to. Yeah. But I'm not sure we are.
Is there an audio version, or is there going to be?
It's coming, next week, I think.
Are you the narrator?
No, Claire Danes. Claire Danes. She may not do the silly voices, but she's actually good at acting. She's not true. Than the Iliad is, as in, for instance, you can read it alongside Joyce. which it would be weird to make your answer on such a
You mentioned that since you wrote the book, that you took the book translation and translations that were previously done.
Yeah.
Was there something for that whole process that just kind of struck you over and over again in terms of how you looked at something and translated then versus a different translator who were all men?
Right. So I've done some like little threads on Twitter where I've done close comparisons of different bits and comparing mine to other translations. And I always feel like I learn things by doing that. It's an interesting exercise. I don't feel they have a macroscopic idea about what I'm going to find out when I do the exercise of just open it and look at how different people did a different passage. We talked about Calypso, and I was kind of struck by how many people both use the word nymph, but also then I think the word nymph can infect the reading of the scene. In that I think quite a lot of translations sort of treat Calypso as more ridiculous because they have the English ideas of nymph in their minds, which aren't actually there in Greek. Looking at the scene when Telemachus decides that he's not going to hack to death the slave women who've been raped by incisions, but instead hang them because they're too dirty for his sword. And I was really surprised to realize how many translators make Telemachus call them things like sluts, when the Greek doesn't do that, it doesn't do anything like that. And I think it's about a reading of a passage. I might have hadn't articulated before doing that research exercise that I read the passage differently from the way I think quite a lot of translators have read it, and commentators too. But I don't think Telemachus is thinking these are people whose sexuality is bad and they're going to be punished for their sexuality by being hanged. I think he's instead thinking and saying, I feel ashamed by the continued existence of these bodies that have been claimed by other men. And that what he's insisting on is erasing his own sense of shame. So even beyond the fact, I didn't feel any push to put in the word slut where there wasn't anything like that in the Greek. I also felt that my perspective on the scene, I realized in retrospect, is not the same as that of other.
Yes. How long was your odyssey to read this book?
5 years. And I was kind of going, and I thought I might need to beg for another couple of years. And I was really stuck at the beginning. It took a long time just to figure out what was my idiom. And then it got a little easier as it went on. But it was 5 years pretty solid work.
And along the same line, is it necessary to concentrate totally on one project like this? Or did you do other things?
I did other things. I mean, at the start, I was finishing up a book about Seneca. While I was starting this. And actually, one of the reasons I love translation so much, there are many reasons, but one is that you can do a couple of lines. You know, if you only have half an hour to need to pick the kids up, you can still do two lines. Whereas if it's writing a chapter, you can't write three sentences of your chapter and then, it's a different kind of process.
I wonder at this point if you know what kind of course of action it's getting in high school. Somebody was read it then or in junior high, and maybe you don't know if the publisher, if you're here now.
I think it's getting adopted quite a lot. I mean, the paperback then just came out, so it was too expensive for most schools to get when it was in hardback. So I think we kind of have to wait and see how it does now that it's cheaper. But I've talked to a lot of high school teachers as well as college professors who seem excited about adopting it. They do it at Columbia now. Yeah. Even in the hardback, they put it in the hardback. Yeah.
Maybe one more question? Or?
Sure.
Do you all have any favorite moments in the story, or are there any moments that you particularly enjoy translating?
I love translating all the descriptive parts, I guess. I mean, all of the moments when there's a description of an action or a preparation of a meal or One favorite is when Hermes is traveling through the waves to get to Calypso's island, and we have a wonderful description of Christos intertwined vines, and it's a place of hiding, and even the streams are hiding other streams. I loved doing all the scripture parts. I mean, I loved doing the character speeches too, and trying to find different voices for them, but there was a different kind of pleasure in the parts where it's sort of more meta about God, where you're thinking both about how do I describe this physical object, but also how is the description happening? What makes it feel like I'm really authoritative about how you get a ship moving on the ocean, even though I have no idea.
It was really fun.
Thank you so much.